Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Cochran, Judge Clary, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Morning, everyone, and welcome to the second argument today for this March 10, 2022 panel of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The next matter on our oral argument calendar is Thomas versus Payne Park and Deed. Council, although we are participating by Zoom and we can see each other's faces and our names, we're only making an audio recording of the proceedings today. So please do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so we can keep track of who's attached to which argument in the oral audio recording. Also, everything has gone smoothly so far today, but if there are any technological hiccups and you, for some reason, can't see or hear any one of us or your opposing counsel, please bring it to our attention and we'll pause the proceedings and try to get the technology caught up to us. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to relators' counsel if you choose to use that time for rebuttal. Whenever you're ready to proceed, you may.
Thank you. My name is Charles Thomas from Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services. I'm here today representing the relator, Victor Thomas. May it please the court. Relator is seeking a hearing to dispute Deed's finding in September of 2020 that he was discharged for excess absences for employment misconduct. His written request for an appeal was denied because it was received 15 days after the statutory time limit. Relator argued that the plain language in paragraphs 1 and 7 of Emergency Executive Order 2005 precluded Deed from ruling that the appeal was untimely because strict compliance with Chapter 268 was waived and suspended. Deed refused to apply the provisions of 2005. Then on certiorari, this court reversed and remanded for the ULJ to determine whether the relator had substantially complied with 268.101 subdivision 2F. The substantial compliance term comes from the MURAC opinion that was issued in March of 2021. Relator now returns to this court a year after the remand because the ULJ refused to apply the substantial compliance standard, refused to accept that strict compliance had really been waived and suspended, and created a new strict compliance standard that relator had to have taken steps within the 20-day appeal period or else could not be found in substantial compliance. The ULJ is in error for at least two reasons. The MURAC opinion listed four elements that can be considered in assessing substantial compliance: whether the relator has a reasonable explanation for not strictly complying, whether he has taken steps to comply and has generally complied with the statute's purpose, whether there is reasonable notice and lack of prejudice to the other parties. The ULJ here did not address any of the factors described in MURAC. The only thing the ULJ looked at was whether the relator had taken steps to comply within the original 20-day appeal time. That language is not in the text of the executive order. That's not what the MURAC opinion says. And this court, in a non-precedential opinion, has just made clear that that's not what MURAC said. The matter of Moose decision was issued on February 14th of 2022, and we've submitted that to the court as supplemental authority. This court has issued five opinions in late appeal cases applying the MURAC case. One of those appeals was 109 days late. One was 103 days late, one was a couple of months late, one was 22 days late, and one was 1 day late. Only the 22-day and the 1 day applicants in the Moose and the IRAD case were remanded for a new look at substantial compliance. So relator's 15-day late is much closer to the 1 day and the 22-day cases than the couple of months and the over 100 days cases. Relator urges this court to stick to the view of MURAC that you issued in the Moose opinion and reverse this ULJ.
Counsel, I have a question regarding that. You've thrown out quite a few cases involving the time sequence and how they were fairly long after the appeal period. Does the appeal period mean anything?
Your Honor, the department strictly construes that, and there's cases that say it's an absolute time limit. During this pandemic, however, the language of the order says that strict compliance is suspended and waived. Those terms have to mean something.
I understand. And I understand what Murad's saying, that the 20 days does not necessarily have to involve substantial compliance within that time period. But what was his explanation in your case, your client's case, for not reasonably meeting the standard in this case? I mean, was there any evidence, for instance, that he called?
Your Honor, we were not able to substantiate a telephone call. When we had a hearing on the issue of timeliness, it was some 7 months after the events. Mr. Thomas was not very good at recalling what he had done. He explained he had no transportation. He had no computer. His phone was not working well. He didn't have a good explanation for what he did during those 20 days, but he clearly did finally connect with a legal aid office, and the lawyer there got the appeal filed. So that's, the statute says you have to file the appeal. That happened. It didn't happen within the time period, but that, we believe, is enough for substantial compliance, because the purpose of that statute is to get an appeal, notify the department, and notify the other parties. All of those things happened. So,
well, let me ask you a follow-up question. I understand your argument, but given that there's no evidence whatsoever that anything was done until legal aid was called and the appeal was filed, does that mean that the appeal period doesn't exist, that you don't have to take any steps during an appeal period?
I think during this particular time period and under the terms of those order, the executive order, waived means that the department's defense of untimeliness is gone. The executive branch has said, we're going to waive this. They didn't have to do that. That order could have been written much more restrictively. It could have said, we'll suspend it if you've done certain things. Again, that was not done. And the other thing that I think is significant here is that the department has never issued any guidance to the ULJs or anything in terms of, here's what this executive order means. Every ULJ seems to do this on their own. None of their decisions are precedential, so that no ULJ has to follow any other opinion. There's no reason really to defer in any way to this single ULJ's interpretation of, well, I'm going to make them do things, you know, before the appeal time, that's the only way to substantially comply. You know, there's been cases in the past where individuals had blundered through the appeal process online and had not gotten to the last screen. We don't have that case here. The Murek case was kind of like that. A lot of times the folks who don't get through the appeal process are not able to articulate the difficulties that they have. Mr. Thomas did testify that he had called. And he says he was told he couldn't appeal any longer. We were not able to get documentation of when those calls might have been made. When he contacted my office, he understood that he couldn't appeal. And so we told him, we're going to appeal, and we'll see if this executive order will apply to you. Because that's what was being done. During that time, we were in the height of the pandemic. People were losing jobs. They couldn't get jobs. It was actually very difficult to reach the department by phone. Again, I would like to have much more evidence of what he did during that time period. We don't have that. We need that.
Not to belabor the point, but he could have appealed by mail.
That is correct.
Okay.
And again, he was not very good at recalling. And at the hearing, what he was able to talk about was why he was fired. And that's what his focus was. He believed it was unfair. And we aren't at the merits yet. And that's where we're trying to get.
Counsel, is this case distinguishable from Moose or at least Deed argues it's distinguishable? Moose wasn't out, but I mean, Deed argues that this case is different than IRAD in that here the AL, the ULJ found addressed the reason for noncompliance. So it wasn't just in the recon order. So it wasn't just simply a determination that no steps were taken within the 20 days, but there was in Deed's view, the ULJ also found that that Thomas didn't demonstrate a reasonable explanation for failing to strictly comply. And on that basis, there isn't any grounds for concluding that there's substantial compliance, because that prong of the substantial compliance, you know, that factor isn't met.
So let me respond to that this way. The MURAC decision only addressed paragraph one of Executive Order 2005. And that's the part that says strict compliance is suspended. And so the MURAC opinion said, and it makes sense, if strict compliance is suspended, it doesn't mean no compliance. So you have to do substantial compliance. And that is the standard that the courts, or that the department and the court has looked at since then. But paragraph seven adds to that, and it says waived. And so, first of all, it's not obvious. I guess I'm not going to argue the MURAC opinion. It's not clear that the substantial compliance is the only way to interpret suspending strict compliance, but it's reasonable. But when strict compliance is waived, then I think that there's plain language that says requiring strictly that he must have taken certain steps within that 20 days, that he's got to be able to recall, that he has to say, this is why I thought about a phone or a letter, and here's why I didn't do it. Again, a lot of folks that are dealing with Deed are not very sophisticated. And so I think that given the language of the executive order, waived means that this late filing should not preclude him from ever getting a hearing. That's our claim. And
so are you asking us to revisit MURAC?
If necessary, but MURAC didn't address paragraph seven. And so to the extent that the executive order is gone now, this is a case that arose during that time. And there is no decision I've seen that addresses what waived means. And so I think a reasonable construction of waived means that the executive branch, by the governor, decided to waive strict compliance with Chapter 268. Well, this is a strict compliance requirement. It has always been that way. There's no good cause. There's no close. There's no, there's nothing. And so when that strictness is waived, the executive branch, and I think that includes Deed, that this has been taken away from them as a basis to deny access to a hearing on the merits. The MURAC decision said Deed must follow and apply the executive order. They had not done so. And so I think paragraph seven does have some meaning. There's a separate claim here, if I can get to that. We asked, as this case has gone on and on, we asked the ULJ to apply the substantial compliance standard from MURAC to the requalification requirement. Because when an individual is disqualified, if they miss their appeal time or if they go to hearing and lose, they can't draw benefits until they've earned $1,500. Well, during the pandemic, that was a very difficult process. People were not getting jobs. Employers were not hiring. And so what we asked is that same executive order that covers all of Chapter 268, that should apply to the requalification requirement as well. Will you consider that he has been sufficiently punished by going without benefits and going without work? That's the purpose of that part of the order, to deter people from quitting their jobs or committing misconduct and thinking they can get benefits because they can't. But after a certain amount of time, that penalty purpose has been served. And so without reaching the substantial compliance or without reaching the paragraph seven argument on the timeliness, the department should have been implementing that order were whoever it affected. And it not only affects people trying to file an appeal, it affects people at other stages of the unemployment process. And one of them is, how can I overcome my disqualification? And so the department has not followed, has not applied that law here, certainly not to this individual, and there's no indication that they've done it to anyone else. That is a separate basis that you could reverse the ULJ and say that was an error. Clearly, we don't know how to raise this issue other than asking the ULJ, who's conducting the proceedings, in the separate issue, would you consider this? So if that is error, that can be reversed and it can be remanded for an award of benefits. We've suggested that 60 days after the disqualification is an appropriate period of time for him to go without work and without benefits. And at that point, he can be declared that he's requalified and he can get benefits. There's no need to address the details of this substantial compliance over the appeal time, because that issue is not going to arise again. The executive order is gone. I don't think there's any more cases in the pipeline like this. And so we'd be happy with a ruling either way. I see my time has expired, so I will. If there are no questions, I'll wait for rebuttal.
Thank you. There don't appear to be any additional questions at this time, so we will return to you for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Carrie Phillips, and I represent the respondent, Department of Employment and Economic Development, or DEED. So the ULJ here correctly determined that the relator did not substantially comply with the appeal deadline because two of the MERAC factors were not met. He did not take steps to comply with the deadline, and he did not have a reasonable explanation for failing to strictly comply. So I'll start with the factor of reasonable explanation. So in the hearing, relator testified that he did not have a computer at the time and it was difficult for him to get transportation. As the ULJ noted in the decision on reconsideration, appeals may be filed online, by mail, and by fax. And relator did not present any evidence that he was prevented from filing an appeal by mail during the appeals period. To the extent that relator testified that he tried to call during the appeal period, the ULJ found this testimony to lack credibility and made a credibility determination in the decision on reconsideration. And the record supports...
Counsel, let me interrupt a minute. What does it mean to you as representative of DEED to go from strict compliance to reasonable compliance? What does that mean to DEED?
Yes. So DEED has been applying the test that was provided by the MERAC court. And so DEED applies those four factors here. And maybe this will more directly answer your question. So DEED interprets the factor has taken steps to comply with the statute to mean that a party has taken steps to comply in the 20-day appeal period.
You don't necessarily honor the Moose decision then, where it's clear that they're suggesting that their interpretation, Merrick, is that it did not limit it to the 20-day appeal period?
Right. We believe that that is inconsistent with Merrick and with the other non-precedential decisions that have been issued after MERAC. And the part of MERAC that we believe is inconsistent is the MERAC court said that the executive order suspended strict compliance, but not all compliance. So the MERAC court is saying that there is still some compliance with that appeal deadline that is required.
But in MERAC, the language about substantial compliance says a party may be said to have substantially complied with the statute, and I'm skipping ahead to the steps taken piece, where she has taken steps to comply with the statute. It doesn't say within 20 days.
It doesn't say that.
And so DEED has read that in, and Moose says that reading is too narrow. So given that, Why shouldn't we reverse and remand similar to what this court did in Moose?
Because if a party waits until after the deadline has passed, that's no compliance. A party can't wait to take steps until the appeal period has passed and still substantially comply with the deadline. The deadline is passed. And this position is consistent with other non-precedential decisions issued after MEREC, including one that was issued this week on Monday. On Monday, Turner versus McGrath came out. And in that case, the ULJ determined that the relator did not substantially comply with the appeal deadline because there was no indication that he filed or took any steps toward filing a request for reconsideration before the deadline. And the court affirmed in that case.
So you take Moose as an outlier case, inconsistent with the other body of law in this area.
Exactly. Moose is an outlier. We've been following the cases Green versus Hazelden Foundation, Sawatsky. Those cases have a similar result as Turner versus McGrath. In all of those cases, the ULJ found that there was no substantial compliance because a party did not show that they took any steps towards complying before the deadline. Awesome. And in each of those cases, the court affirmed the ULJ's decision. So Moose is different than all of those other cases. And Deed struggles a little bit to reconcile how Moose is consistent with MEREC and those other cases.
Okay. Counsel, just to be clear on this, if somebody... While this governor's order was still in effect, if somebody filed the day after the 20 days were up, would be Deed's position that they had not substantially complied if nothing was done the first 20 days? Do you understand?
Yes. I believe I understand your question. And that factor then would not be met. If they did not take any steps to file an appeal within the 20 days,
counsel,
Deed would...
Can I follow up just for a minute, Jane?
Sorry. Yeah, I have a follow-up after you.
Okay. My one quick question is, if it's one day late, how is that, and you find that they have not complied, how is that not strict compliance?
How is that not? Well, let me see if I understand your question. We would look, if they had, taken a step towards complying, it still may be substantial compliance. If they had done something that would be a step towards complying yet not actually complied, that would still be substantial compliance. So it's not strict compliance. And I'll give you an example of the Arad case, which was remanded. He filed one day late. In his appeal statement, he said, I tried to file the appeal and it didn't work. And the court remanded for a hearing. If the evidence were to show that he tried to get online, he tried to go through that process within the 20 days and something didn't work, that could be a step taken within the 20 days, even though he didn't file within the 20 days. So in this case, we have nothing. We have no evidence of any steps taken within the 20 days. So that factor is not met here. I would also
hypothetically, I'm sorry, did you have a further point with regard to that question?
No, thank you. Go ahead, please.
Okay, thank you. Hypothetically, someone gets the appeal notice in the mail and they don't understand it. They have a question about it. They call Deed on the 10th day, Deed's line. They can't get through. This is back in the pandemic when Deed is inundated with calls. They can't get through. They try again on the 15th day. They can't get through. They try again on the 22nd day. They get through and Deed tells them it's too late. But then they go ahead and file. They go talk to Smurls. They figure out how to file and they go ahead and file on the 30th day. Are those calls that were made to Deed, in your view, steps towards complying?
That's certainly an argument that those are steps toward complying. And those may be, and ULJ may find those to be steps that were taken to comply and may find that to be substantial compliance. Here, there was no credible evidence that anything like that happened. Two different judges scoured the Deed records in the Deed system to see if there was any evidence of phone calls, of documents submitted, of an appeal attempt And then, of course, there was the hearing where the relator was had the opportunity to provide evidence of that. And the ULJ found that there is no evidence of any steps taken. To answer your question, I think those would be steps. There would be an argument that those would be steps towards filing an appeal. And there was nothing like that in this case. And I would also distinguish this case from Moose. Because in Moose, there wasn't a hearing on substantial compliance. So the court did remand to have that hearing. And in Moose, the ULJ didn't find that there was no reasonable explanation. Here, there was a hearing on substantial compliance, and the ULJ did make that determination that the relator did not have a reasonable explanation for failing to strictly comply. So this case is different from Moose in that way. And again, we do have some. I think I already mentioned this, but just to make sure, there are other non-precedential decisions that have been issued after MURAC that interpret the factor in the same way that Deed has been doing it, that affirms when a ULJ finds a party hasn't taken any steps. So if the standard is something different, if a party can satisfy that factor by taking steps after the 20 days, you know, all of those decisions would be incorrect.
Following up on that, you pointed us to Turner v. McGrath. What other cases are you, and you maybe mentioned those earlier, but I wanted to go back and write them down just to make sure I'm clear.
Sure. Yeah. So Sawatsky versus Harris Rochester Incorporated, that was issued on July 19th. 2021, numbers A21-0269. In that case, the ULJ dismissed the appeal. This was before MURAC, but the ULJ, the ULJ didn't apply substantial compliance. But the court determined that even so, the record could not support a finding of substantial compliance because the relator failed to provide a reasonable explanation for failing to appeal and also failed to show that he took steps to comply with the statute. So, you know, and let me keep answering your question. Other cases was E-Rod. That was the one that was remanded. You talked a little bit about that one. E-Rod is not inconsistent with our position. Like I said, in E-Rod, there was evidence that needed to be developed in a hearing as to whether he took that step during the 20 days.
E-Rod isn't inconsistent with Moose either, I don't think.
That could be.
And Swatsky, you mentioned, is pre-MURAC, so I'm not sure that.
No, I'm sorry. It's not pre-MURAC. I meant that the ULJ dismissed it before MURAC, and so didn't do the substantial, but the court analyzed substantial compliance under MURAC.
Right. I'll go back and look at that, but I don't think the court talked about substantial compliance within 20 days.
I believe,
And Swatsky.
The court said that Sawatsky failed to show that he took steps to comply with the statute.
So generally,
yes. So, you know, if we were to take the position that relator is urging the court to adopt, I mean, all of these relators took a step eventually because they filed an appeal. And, you know, in these cases, the ULJ found they did not take steps to comply within the 20 days and the court affirmed. But you're right, it doesn't parse it before and after, you know. Green versus Hazelden Foundation, that was issued on September 27th, 2021. Hellquist versus Independent School District 709, Duluth Public Schools. In that case, the court affirmed the dismissal on grounds that the argument wasn't briefed. So that one might not be as helpful. And then I mentioned Turner versus McGrath, which was issued this week. So in those cases, the court did affirm the ULJ when the ULJ found the party did not take steps to comply before the deadline.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I'll move on briefly to the relator's second argument today about addressing substantial compliance with the requalification requirements. So as stated in Christgau versus Fine, the only question before the court in this matter today is whether the ULJ's decision to dismiss relator's appeal as untimely was correct. And the determination that was dismissed did not determine anything about requalification. It only held that relator was ineligible based on the separation, and then it stated that requalification language on it. It didn't make any determination as far as whether he did requalify or not. And in general, when an applicant provides information showing that he's requalified, deed issues a document titled Determination and Indefinite Denial. So it's a separate determination that holds ineligibility ends on a certain date. And then an applicant has the opportunity to appeal that determination. Here, that hasn't been issued because relator hasn't provided any information showing that he has requalified by earning those wages in subsequent employment. But it is a separate issue. It wasn't before the ULJ. The ULJ didn't make any determination on that, and it's not before the court today. I believe those are my points that I wanted to cover today. If there aren't any other questions from the panel, I'll just conclude. So in conclusion, the ULJ correctly determined that the relator did not substantially comply with the appeal deadline. Relator did not have a reasonable explanation for failing to comply, and he did not take any steps to comply. Therefore, deed respectfully requests that the court affirm the ULJ's decision today. All right, thank you.
And thank you. Counsel for relator.
Thank you. It's pretty clear that deed.
And just a reminder, if you could begin with your name.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Charles Thomas, representing the relator.
Thank you.
It's pretty clear that deed is committed to strict compliance in every way possible. That there's no willingness to be flexible
I'm not sure if that's accurate. I think the argument is that is a recognition that strict compliance isn't necessary, provided there were steps that were taken during the deadline period that would show some effort to try to comply with the statute, including the deadline.
I think they are focused entirely on that first step, that first element from the dangers decision that was talked about in Murak. And Murak said, you may show substantial compliance by these factors. It's not the only way. Again, as we pointed out, whenever strict compliance usually comes up, someone has missed a deadline or they've done something and then they say, oops, let me try to do it now. And usually that doesn't work. And we put in our briefing the cases where the court has said, yes, substantial compliance is good enough in these limited cases. Usually that doesn't work. But Murak established that as the standard. And so here, deed does not look at the lack of prejudice, does not look at compliance with the purpose, does not look at reasonable notice. All of those factors have been satisfied. They are focused on, you must have done something within those 20 days. That is our strict view of substantial compliance. And that's what we think is improper. We've argued that. But beyond that, that doesn't address what waived means. Waived is another plain language basis to say holding him strictly to either appealing within 20 days or attempting to appeal within 20 days and being able to document that 7 or 8 months later, you have to strictly comply with that substantial compliance standard. That doesn't make sense. The purpose of that executive order was to make things easier for the department and I think for the workers. That's what that said. Strict compliance is suspended and waived to give some flexibility.
In your view, is there any limit as to when an appeal can be filed by someone who received a notice of denial during the peacetime emergency? In other words, you know, strict compliance with the 20-day period is waived. Does that mean 2 years down the road they can still file an appeal?
I'm not sure I would represent that particular client who had been that dilatory. But suppose an individual was hospitalized and was unconscious for their entire 20-day appeal period. That's not an exception under the current law. If they were if it was 6 months, I might take that person's case and say they are within this exception. They might not have a substantial claim because they're not able to work, but the technical ability to get the separation issue heard, I think I would argue that. This is a very limited law that we're dealing with, the executive orders, because they're gone. It's unlikely that someone is going to assert a claim now from back then. It's possible, and those things would have to be dealt with on the merits, and it could be that that's unreasonable. I haven't had a 100-day case yet. I think I would have to think carefully about that. But again,
so if someone was hospitalized due to COVID, say, for a long period of time, and wasn't able to take any steps during that time, during the 20-day period.
Right. They would fail under the department's view of substantial compliance because they didn't do anything. Sitting in their hospital bed worrying about it would not be enough. So I want to just briefly address one issue that arose here, and it deals with the telephone calls. We made a request for data. All the contacts that Mr. Thomas had by computer or phone with the department. And the department said, you may not request data. We think that's wrong. And we think that the court should make a ruling that this is an erroneous procedure, an unlawful procedure that interferes with individuals' rights to bring their cases before the department and to litigate them. Asking for that information goes directly to what were the steps that might have been taken that we could show. And they refused. We did get some data. We didn't have time within all that to fight about whether that was complete. That's a separate issue that arose in this case, and we think that that should be addressed so that that doesn't happen to another individual. I see my time has concluded. Thank you. We would ask for a ruling not remanding this for another look at timeliness, but remanding for a hearing on the merits.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments.